I'm Dave.
I'm Dan.
Dan's VP head of sales for a Silicon Valley software company.
Dave's a serial tech entrepreneur, board advisor, and CIO.
We come at things from very different perspectives.
But we usually find a way to meet in the middle.
Which is fortunate because Dan's my son.
Welcome to Bridging Business and IT.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Bridging Business and IT. A couple months ago, we did a long conversation with a good friend of mine, Brent Granato. And the conversation was so entertaining, at least for the three of us, that we wound up running out of time for the first go around. So we scheduled some time to do it again, which we've done. So we had talked a lot about investment capital in really focused in the technology space. That was the first go-around. It's a highly summarized discussion of the first podcast. But we wanted to get into a deeper conversation on how venture funds use technology and how the firms that they invest in used technology. So that's the big piece of this conversation, the actual application of technology for the investors and for the funds or for the firms in which they invest. So I won't give a long background today. Dan, if you had any other comments, please go ahead and share them.
Yeah, I'll just share that it was really fun to ask Brent about his tech stack and all the different SaaS that he uses and the various ways that he uses it. It was fun to reflect on sort of observing that tech stack evolve over the last couple of decades. Specifically the last decade, even just that I've been in it. And there's some really fun sections where he talks about the movement of very large sums of money and how that actually happens in the real world. I think people will find that part really interesting because I know I did.
Yeah, I think you're right. Okay, guys, with that, we'll shut up and we'll get into the actual conversation. We'll talk to you soon. Hey guys, how's everybody today?
Doing good.
Yeah. Dipped Andy.
Dipped Andy. Really good. Pumped up for part two here.
And psyched. Yeah, I know. I'm looking forward to it as well. So we were here once again with our brother, Brent Granato, the bag man.
I love it. Wow. Thank you.
That's a compliment. That's a big compliment, right?
It's high praise. It's very
high praise. That's the guy that makes the money. I'm being serious. I've been hearing like the get the bag. It's becoming a popular turn of phrase, but I've never actually known where that come from.
Well, I got to tell you, this is the first time my initials actually are turning into something cool. It's actually bag. And
you're here with the bag man.
There you go. All right.
But that's what it means, right? It's the guy that, I mean, it's a good thing. It's the guy that gets the money.
I'd have to ask my son.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm not young enough or hip enough.
I'll run that one by him tonight.
Okay. Well, speaking of money,
yes,
companies and all the rest of the stuff, we had talked a while ago in earlier episodes about private equity and what it means, the various aspects of it, how you do it, how you raise it, how it's changed over the course of the last three decades or four decades. The second part of the conversation that we were hoping to have is how do you use technology, both as a private equity investor and how do you use it within a private equity investment? And that's gained a little bit more impetus recently, and that the Wall Street Journal has recently run some articles on the relative dearth of understanding of technology in the boardroom and some of the issues with board members not being quite as fluent on technological issues as they might otherwise be on other topics. So I think that's something that we really wanted to explore today and get into in a fairly sizable way. So, Brent, I know your portfolio is a little bit unique in that so much of what you do is tech-focused, which means tech is the center of every conversation. But for all of those who are not, you know, let's, you know, give us a sense of where you see the deficiencies.
Yeah, so I'll start by saying that 75% of the portfolio is definitely tech. It is a tech, not tech-centered, not tech-enabled, but actually a technology business. So in those particular circumstances, it's always going to be at the forefront. It's at every board meeting and how you're building your technology. And even if you have to use other layers of the tech stack? How is that implemented and how are you going to orchestrate that? So that's continuous dialogue. We do 25% of our businesses where I think a lot of people would say, well, it's not a technology company. And they're typically, you know, consumer facing businesses in those particular circumstances. And they do have their own tech stacks. And I think every company today is a tech enabled business. I think that if you're not, you're way behind the curve. I mean, this is as simple as having an ERP system or CRM system in place, because how are you going to, you know, manage your sales if you don't have a CRM? Maybe you're working off of LinkedIn, and even then, that's still a CRM system for some folks. So, mm-hmm. But I would say that things are getting orchestrated and built in a way that are a lot more streamlined and efficient today. A lot of companies that are consumer facing now have a number of tools they can draw on, because marketing is not just your classic form of marketing where it could, you know, used to be just marketing led to advertising, and advertising was done on television or print. You now have omni channels out there. So you're constantly hitting, whether it be social media, you can do the old traditional format of media, of TV and print. But I think the reality is there's companies that like to drill down even further, and they use social media channels as one of their strongest pursuits, because they're able to find attribution. Now, attribution requires other tools, right? And so mm-hmm. these companies have to invest in a number of different tools as they're thinking about the target audience they're going after. And, you know, depending on the audience, each audience uses different modes of acquiring insights about a product. It could be, you know, people in your generation, Dave.
That are
getting their insights from
stone tablets. Is that what you're suggesting?
I was going to be
that's where you were going, but yeah,
I was going to say more from cable news television advertisements.
Ah, yeah. Oh, so you're throwing me in the Fox crowd,
or maybe HGTV. But beyond that, I mean, then you have more Dan's particular category and younger that are consuming a lot of the content via social media streams. So whether it be apps or you know, even web traffic, you've got to go through those. There's numerous stacks for that, and there's ways to measure that too. So it's not just attribution, it's measurement. And then where are you going to put your dollars and optimize use of your marketing dollars? And so, yeah, you can drill into many different rabbit holes and many different categories. It'd be operational as well. I mean, I mentioned ERP systems. You could be using tools and understanding kind of supply chain and fulfillment needs. It goes on and on and on. And these conversations are continuously happening in the boardroom. I think the one remaining item that is almost prevalent across all companies. So I do say that my companies that are on the tech side don't, you know, we're always talking about it. But what we're also always talking about is cyber. Cybersecurity is so beyond prevalent right now in every single business. And one of the things that we realized as part of cybersecurity, and I think it's just been this way for probably the last 10 years, is every threat comes from different places. And in many, many cases, the threats are changing over time. And so
changing rapidly over time.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And so what tool that you may have bought back in, you know, 2005, which was probably some really chintzy tool that told you you're being attacked, but did nothing for you, has evolved through the many, many years where now you're like, well, do I need network security? Do I need cloud security? Do I need a blend of both? Is it for, you know, certain types of attacks, or do I just need to be aware of what the attacks are? Do I need to remediate them? And so there's just so many things that are thrown at these boards, thrown at management for that matter, because they're the ones that are initially encountering it. And whether it be they're encountering it because they're being attacked, or because the regulatory bodies that they work within, think about healthcare, is insisting that they have this. There's cyber policies now, insurance policies that are going through the roof. And frankly, they're probably going to disappear in about 5 years. So you really have to have this coverage through some way, shape, or form. And as a board member, you have a fiduciary obligation to all of your shareholders to protect against those kind of attacks happening.
Okay, so let's start unpacking some of that. There, you covered an awful lot of territory in a fairly short amount of time. Okay, so one thing that I want to go back and touch on is you're talking about the different channels that people would be looking at to analyze for, you know, their go-to-market strategy. It's been my experience in the past, and it's been a while since I dug into this in a big way. You're a lot more current on it than I am. But when I've worked with some large private equity groups previously, I found that there was a pretty noticeable demarcation between B2B companies and B2C. So people that were consumer focused were a lot more up on the current, right? I mean, they had to be. They had to be much more mindful of the different channels, the different options, of just the feedback that was coming from the market in terms of what they did, how they interacted, and all the rest. If you were somebody that didn't interface with consumers, to some extent, your job was easier.
Well, I think your job's more reliant on other people's data.
Yeah, that's probably good.
And that can be dangerous, or it can be really, or it can be easier. I mean, I think that's really, I think that becomes some of the challenges for some businesses, right? And, you know, if, and I kind of maybe use saying that out of turn, because that's more when I'm thinking about a B2B to C kind of arrangement. I think if it's B2B, you still are in pretty control of the data that you're engaging, right? I imagine Dan at his organization has really good clarity as to feedback loops he's getting from customers or potential customers.
One thing that I always saw that I thought was kind of interesting, where I kind of felt like there was a glaring hole, was in the entire infrastructure space, or awareness of that, and failover and redundancy, disaster recovery, and all the rest. I always found that there was a pretty enormous ignorance. I'm going to label it that way, and I think that's fair, of what it meant to be down, of the financial impact of what happens when you're offline. So if, you know, when you're down, I remember doing an assessment for a construction company that was a roll-up for Blackstone. And, you know, they had about 2,500 users, as I remember. But the cost of being down for an hour, a very conservative estimate, was like $750,000. It was real money.
Yep.
Because, you know, if you were down, all of our people were sitting around, you know, sitting on their hands. You couldn't do anything. I don't think that awareness, you know, goes up to the board level very often. I don't think they're quite mindful. So, you know, correct me if you think I'm wrong, but it was a hole that I used to see.
No, and it's fair. I think it's becoming more prevalent today, and this falls under the cybersecurity umbrella, because what's happened is, because of a number of attacks, people didn't have the backup systems, right? So what would happen is they'd have their entire system hijacked. If you want access back to your servers, whether they be cloud or on-prem, however they worked it out, you need to pay this ransom, right? So that really sprung a number of companies that have decided to spend a lot of time and effort solving that problem. And now that that's become an accessible software solution, it is definitely on the forefront of numerous board discussions. And I will say, like, obviously these things are at different stages of a business. I think as you become more and more enterprise oriented, obviously the more and more you need it. I think in the earlier stages, it almost becomes, I don't even know if it's cost effective to have these solutions, just because they're so expensive. But I do think as you watch an organization grow into what would be considered, and we've talked about these stages, but growth equity, they become more and more a necessity, because going down in that circumstance, there's no hiding it, right? There's no ability to hide that.
Yeah.
And I feel like part of your question could be framed in this way too, which is, you know, Brent's earlier answer, you know, the first piece of technology out of your mouth or use case was how to drive sales, marketing, awareness, and conversion revenue. Isn't this also, how do you weigh, technology investments that can drive near-term results in terms of dollars versus longer-term preventative type stuff. That's a big challenge. Do you have any frameworks for that?
Yeah. So I'm going to go back to the fact that we're in private equity. I'm not as challenged with the near-term results as, say, a public board that is constantly, you know, having the quarterly pressures that they encounter. And so is there a magical tool out there that can help my conversion rates increase over the next quarter? A lot of the discussions we have as a board are more about long-term building, and they fit within the product roadmap that's actually being built for the organization. And so where would we layer in these things in order to optimize them once we have them built? Once we know that customers want them, and then how do we then put the investment into that so we can really get a higher ROI out of that build? I know I'm forgetting what the first part of your question was.
No, you got it. That orients the focus. I know I have a follow up, but Dad, I cut you off a second ago. What did you want to say?
Well, I was going to go back to the whole issue of cyber once again. 10, 15 years ago, I don't think most board members were aware of the fact that the hacker toolkits could be purchased online like a checkout at Amazon.
Most definitely.
And, you know, that's very much a reality. And I think a lot of people don't have any idea that that's going on. The tools available to hackers can literally be downloaded. You can go and say, okay, I want to steal 5,000 names. I want to steal them from this company. Swipe your own credit card and they'll go out and do it for you. So there are SaaS applications for hackers to steal your data, which is just kind of surreal that there's this entire ecosystem built up around this stuff. I don't think an awful lot of board members are mindful of that. The level of sophistication is pretty extreme. The other thing that I don't think a lot of board members are mindful of, and again, you know, correct me if you think I'm wrong, but I've got a good close friend who is a cybersecurity expert who tells me regularly that he'll go into meetings, and we're going to have to get him on the podcast in the not too distant future, but he goes into meetings with the executive committees and he'll look around and say, I see that the most important person in the company is not here. And they will all look at him kind of askance and say, what are you talking about? The CEO is here, the COO, the CFO, right? CIO, the CISO, they're all here. You know, what do you mean the most important person isn't in this meeting? And he says, you know, 80 to 90% of all of the holes in your security are human related. You don't have your chief human resource officer here. Yeah, this is a people issue still, first and foremost.
Most definitely.
It's you know, you can put up all the barriers you want to electronic entry, but if somebody makes the wrong keystroke or clicks yes to that phishing exercise, you're doomed.
Well, and so I will say this. Like, yes, I suppose the head of HR would be a good person to have in the room, but it is an organization that's doing right. It's obviously having training done in addition to this, as well as an organization that's, you know, most likely to be subject to phishing attacks is also using software that simulates phishing attacks almost all year long. And so anytime you have someone that's, you know, clicked on something, thankfully that was associated with the software as opposed to an actual hacker, you can then remediate or you can address that issue directly with that individual and have another training and a reminder as to, like, you know, all these different steps you should be going through before you click on any link or whatever the circumstance might have been. So yes, I agree with you. I don't think there's challenges at every level. I would say that's probably more a common circumstance where like the head of HR should be in the room for an organization that is either, you know, pretty sizable at enterprise level again, or at a very small organization. I hate to say it, but like, there's just too many chefs in the kitchen at a board level when you're trying to actually get something done. You can't, I mean, having more than five board members is really a challenge. Because then you have some observers and they've got an opinion, and which is great. I mean, as long as it's additive, but like there's just a lot of moving pieces. And I, you know, for an organization that's growing really fast, you got to focus on those things that are really key. You should be having dialogues in between your board meetings. I think that's the other thing that I think a lot of people think, well, they only meet once a quarter or so. Obviously they're not very good or very helpful. No. I can tell you, like, I've had probably the equivalent of a board meeting with three different companies this week. And it happens every week. So
I don't think a lot of people realize that you're managing your board on pretty much a weekly basis.
Yeah. I mean, I got to be honest. Like, I don't think I would ever want to be a CEO ever.
It's Brent, do you not take some offense to that statement? Do you feel like you're being managed by your portfolio companies?
No. No, I don't. I really do see them as partnerships, but it is, there are circumstances where either we're being managed or they're being managed, right?
Right. Just, yeah, there's circumstances really
right. where you tend to turn at times. Now look, I think when everything's working well, and I call it a partnership, like I always just tell our board, like I'm an additional member of, if you want to call me additional member of your management team. However, like I'm here and I'm not only here as a member to add value, but like I'll be thinking of ways I can add value. And I'm not going to bother you or disrupt you, unless it's really critical, but that's the way it should be working. I mean, I hear lots of horror stories, but I also know lots of great board members that have been amazingly helpful. Hugely beneficial to an organization.
Yep. Well, I think Silicon Valley overall in the last 20 years has really moved in that direction. They become far more valuable. Yep. Yeah, they used to talk about it, but now I think they really are.
So to that end,
let me
ask this follow up. So I love that you just talked about the frequency of conversations. I wanted to delve into this actually. So my follow-up is, for a formal board meeting, can you tell us about your preferred structure? How do these run? How long do they go? Who is in the room? What deck are you presenting from? Who's presenting? And what topics do you expect to be sort of updated on versus where things transition into brainstorming or collaborations or whatever?
Yeah. So I'll start with the length of these. They should probably be no longer than 3 hours. You know, sometimes things are going amazingly well and you're touching base continuously as a collective board in between meetings, and they can be as short as 2 hours. I think for us, the key items are just kind of like, what's the state of the union from the last meeting, just so we compare metrics being not only financials, but KPIs that the organization has built with the board. I think that's really helpful is when the board is actively involved in that, so that everyone's on the same page with how things are being measured. And every organization is going to have different measurements. Some will be quite similar and others are going to just be unique. But so we'll run through those. I think there are times where it makes a ton of sense to have certain department heads come in and report to the board on developments, whether it be, you know, the sales team has added X number of new employees and they're going after a new target. What's the strategy? Why are you going about it this way? And why is it the most, you know, where you think it's going to be return the greatest return on the investment? Same can be said for numerous other departments. We've had the CTO most often come in because it's either product development and staying on task with whether it be a product pipeline or just what's been happening, talking about cyber threats because they generally are the touch point for managing that if there's not a CISO in the organization at that point. Trying to think. Oh, we definitely have the HR person come in and speak with us because for the most part, a number of our companies are growth oriented. So with that being said, you're talking about onboarding new employees, how that's coming along, how they're going about the process of recruiting, retention policies, lots going on around how they're going to keep people actively involved and engaged as employees. And then I would say after the majority of that is addressed, there's a session that happens where, you know, everyone else is kicked out and it's just the board. Now the board makeup for the most part is, in our circumstances are typically, we'll say if I'm over talking a room of five, there's three investors and then two common holders. The common holder, one for sure is the CEO. The second one could be the founder or co-founder or whatever the situation is. And their role could be the CTO, could be the head of strategy, whatever their strength was when the organization was built, and they're still actively involved. So the conversations at that point are just more around, you know, where is the strategy heading now, the sensitive subjects of what's happening in the organization. Mm-hmm. And as you can imagine, there's a lot of different things that come up in any type of organization that are kind of strange, you know, like and just things that are unexpected. Or what you'll find and what recently came up in one of our discussions was, you know, this company's been around for a while. They've been implementing the product for numerous years, and a potential customer out of a completely different industry came over and said, "We think we can use this for this," and wanted to know what kind of customizations would be required and whether or not that would be even of interest. And so kind of discussing what impact that would have on, you know, the ripple effect across the organization. What does it do for our product roadmap? What does it do to our, you know, our development team? All those sorts of things. And whether or not it's worth making the effort or passing on it for now.
Yeah.
Simply go for customers, right? Yeah. Customers can be problematic, and should we churn them out as opposed to trying to continually satisfy them and allow them to be disruptions?
So that is, I don't have a long track record with board engagements directly, but that tracks perfectly with what I have experienced so far. What I'd love to ask you about is, so my experience has been in the tech-centric world. And you talked about the percentage of your portfolio that is non-tech, that is more tech-enabled, that might be CPG or whatever. So this is kind of a multi-part question, but I'm curious how tech gets discussed differently. When we're talking about the success of IT projects and the potential for technology to transform a business for the positive, which is what we're always trying to do every week, every board cycle, every month, is it different to you? Versus when you're talking about tech projects and a tech company where 40% of the headcount of that company is a developer, right, versus where, a retailer where maybe 1% of the company employees are technical.
I would say it's different in a couple of ways. Like if it's a CPG company, it's different just because we're talking about totally different tools. They're just, but at the same time, I would say this, like this isn't like the 1990s or even the early 2000s. Like the people that are now in the management roles aren't ones that I have to sit there and go like, "Hey, have you thought about XYZ as an A/B testing kind of tool?" Like they're coming to us and saying like, "Wow, we're going to evaluate these three. I see that you're like," and this dialogue will happen all the time. Like, "I see that you're an investor in this company that you're on the board of this company. We'd love to understand kind of the inner workings and why you as an investor decided to go with them, because why over so-and-so company?"
Those companies are trying to sell to the company asking the question.
Absolutely. And it's a really hard situation because I don't want to sway the outcome. I can, but at the end of the day, like I can open that door, right, and say, "Hey, I'm happy to introduce you to the CEO or the head of sales or the CTO, whatever it is, if it's a technical question." So it's a little different, right? Like I think that it's more proactive today than it was. I think everyone realizes that technology's it's table stakes. Like you cannot compete without it. And anybody that's trying to get by without it is being left in the dust. So I think for us, I think the conversation that happens more often on the consumer side is, why aren't you investing enough in it? As opposed to, you know, should we be implementing it?
Very interesting. Yeah, that's very interesting. And that is actually just an aside. I mean, we were referencing some of this literature we were reading on the role of board members in really large companies, where it was that other dynamic that you were talking about, which was, we don't really understand it. We don't know how to measure it. Why would we be talking about it? More of like, you got to prove to us that this is worth doing versus you got to prove to me that this isn't worth doing.
That's right.
You should be doing it, obviously.
There's just so many. I think the key piece is finding the right technology for your particular need, because there's just so much out there now. And I think it all starts with an idea, and someone goes, well, I worked over at this place and it worked for this. And okay, oh, it's great. Like, so now you're in, you know, let's call it content development or whatever the situation might be. That's fantastic, but they don't know anything about this space. So maybe you should look at a semi-competitor that does. And right. So that's the kind of dialogue I think that's more inclined to happen in a boardroom. A lot of these guys, quite honestly, that are bringing the tools to the forefront are incredibly knowledgeable about this, have lived and breathed it much more than we have. So our experiences are, there's times where I'm just like, oh no, I'm learning a lot more here than I should be. but yeah, I mean,
happens to all
the
of
idea
us.
Is to just, I think as a board member, ultimately the idea is to challenge what the perceptions are of those that are coming to you with what they'd like to acquire, right?
Yeah.
And just ask questions around it, right? We're dangerous enough to have been around a number of technology companies to know where maybe some of the sales lines are not legitimate versus where the actual product can do well. And so to that end, I think that's where our role probably shines through more on like these CPG or industrial kind of companies.
Well, that makes total sense. Do you have any favorite examples of where you've seen tech enabled? I know you'll have to anonymize, but any stories that pop out?
Yeah, I mean, so let me think about this. Yes, from a marketing perspective, there's two different kinds of circumstances. I think on the services side, which we're not a big investor on the services side, but this is from an experience from talking with another board member that sat on a board with services company. They were struggling with trying to figure out how to reach certain folks at the C-level. And doing it on a mass scale, because it's almost impossible. So as you, Dave,
so hard.
And myself have sat here, like I can open, I'm looking at my junk mail box, and I've got 600 unopened items. So how do you get around that? How do you build, an approach that you can reach C-level folks? So he was telling me about how they had at the organization had spent a lot of time looking for companies that could do that. And they had uncovered like one of three that was, or they had uncovered all three, but they had gone with one of them and had spoken very highly of them and said, hey, if you ever need it, like, let me know. But that had really actually worked out for them and had exploded their pipeline in a way that was really surprising. And so, That was, you know, one success story. Other than that, like I've seen it on the CPG side. I mentioned the advertising and the attribution. I think attribution tools are great. I think it really does help drill down into who's buying and what their common habits are. And when they're clicking through on certain advertisements versus not, and, you know, are they spending any time in it, or was it a mistake, you know, that they pushed the button? All those sorts of tidbits of information that can then be put into some form of a dashboard. So you have all these analytics around a customer base or individual customers. Those kinds of tools have been incredibly valuable when you're focused on that particular segment, right? And that's the key. Like if you're selling, I don't know, old used cars, that may not be your your target, but if you're selling I don't know, gaming or, you know, lots of different things that are more targeted towards the younger generation, then those tools are amazing.
Well, I think there's more to it than that. We talked about this a little bit the last time, that it also depends upon the macroeconomic environment, right? So the last 15 years, we've been in a situation where revenue is king. You know, you were trying to drive revenue as fast and as furiously as you possibly could. Now,
can I interject really quickly on that? I'm sorry, because I almost caught myself right after I said it when I said, you know, are you spending enough on marketing or on these technology tools?
I wasn't going to go back and hit that, but
did you forget what month
I was
going
to have you go back and delete it. but I figured I'd just address it now. Yeah, I do think that some of that dialogue has been pared back a bit. But I do think that, look, when you've uncovered what works and what works well, and that the generation of revenue is at a very high margin because of the tool that you found, you double down on it.
Yeah, right. You're right. Right. I agree with all that.
I love the joke. I don't know who said it, Brent. You probably know. Only 50% of your marketing is ever going to work. Problem is, you don't know which 50% it was. Attribution works at high scale or at low, high spend or low spend. The part that matters is, do you know what is working, and can you continually reallocate to the stuff that's working more? So that's a beautiful example of tech that moves the needle.
Yeah.
Sorry, Dad. What were you saying?
Well, no. So I agree with all of that. Great observations. But the thing that I'm particularly interested in is, you know, the place where I've always been primarily interested in, operational efficiency. And I keep seeing illustrations of it. I've seen illustrations in the last couple of weeks. I heard another story about it yesterday of major, you know, big companies struggling to figure out how the hell they're going to efficiently deliver what they do.
Yeah.
And there doesn't seem to be a tremendous amount of focus or clarity, certainly within the IT organization, as to what it is that the business is trying to do and how they can help that conversation. They don't see, you know, the whole podcast is called Bridging Business and IT, and had people make the observation, we've been talking about it for 30 years. We're no better at it today than we were 30 years ago when we started. Right. I think that's a very valid point. It's not a technology issue. It's not a project governance issue. It's a business issue. It's squarely a business issue. But it's got to start with the business. These are business projects. They're never technology projects. They're a business project that just happens to be enabled by technology, right? In every case. So I guess my question in all of that pontificating is, do you see people starting to wander back towards, hey, you know, we need to tighten our belts. We need to get better at what we do. Because there's an awful lot of waste that falls through the cracks.
Oh, sure. And you're saying, are they investing to do so?
Yeah. Or are they thinking about it?
I guess thinking about it comes first.
But, you know, you have to be sufficiently aware of the problem to know that it's something that you need to attend to.
Yeah.
So awareness, thinking, and then action.
So definitely awareness. And I think awareness happens when, obviously, and you've pointed it out, right? You see a switch over in the marketplace, tightening of the belt. You start looking for ways in which you can save some money. You've been bloated. You've had a huge balance sheet. Now you're like, well, what I thought I had, let's say 2 years of runway is now, you know, dipped down to potentially one. So where am I going to cut? I would say that there is a lot of software that has been acquired in an organization in hopes that it was going to generate some form of return in a looser period of time. That probably just sits and burns the balance sheet. I've organizations that have purchased Salesforce, for example, and there's nothing wrong with it. It's just, there's a lot of, there's a lot of requirement for adoption with an organization to truly make it useful. And for those that don't know the value of it, they may struggle with trying to adopt it. And it's sometimes, obviously, there's organizations that build overlays for it to simplify it even more. It's incredibly powerful. However, if you discover that your organization, only 30% of your organization, and I should say only 30% of your sales team, and that means even less of your organization is using it, then you're just wasting money. So either you have to figure out how to get them to adopt it and really use the power of it, or figure out a way out of it.
That's a really good point. So, Dan, you've been in three large organizations that have all used Salesforce.
Mm-hmm.
How do you get your people to use it?
You know, it's a little bit of a tough question, because in my world, everyone has grown up on it, to be honest. Now, that said, so the question actually isn't about my experience in tech, because everyone is, it's just ingrained in the culture. It's a psyche. Mm-hmm. It's, if you didn't give it to them, they'd freak out. So it's one of those tools. It's massive. It becomes part of your DNA once you do start using it. So we have a DNA around it. But when I worked at, Honeywell, I lived through a migration to Salesforce. That was interesting. We went from Homebrew to Salesforce. And, there was a near mutiny by the Salesforce. Literally the chatter on the street was, they're putting this in place to track every step that we take so that they can fire us. there was no benefit, no upside in this whatsoever. There was nothing potentially positive could come from better tracking analytics. It was simply so that they could fire us. So I've seen that. I don't know that I necessarily felt that way myself. I didn't make it through. I was gone before the migration finished, because it was multi-year.
Yeah,
I'm sure. But does that answer your question? I mean, I love it. Let me say it this way. I love my CRM today. I'm a leader. And so
it's incredibly powerful.
It's incredibly powerful.
But it's only as good as what's put in it. That's the thing.
It's only as good as what's put in it. So it is important that you build that culture around it, that you have conversations. And I think chatter, this is not a Salesforce ad, but I think chatter is one of the most powerful adoption tools within Salesforce, because that's where discussion and strategy happens around the record types. Maybe the record is an account. Maybe the record is an opportunity. Maybe the record is a specific person that you're trying to engage with. But the point is that the conversation around the strategy and moving the ball from A to B, how are we going to do that? And the discussion and the decision that's got to get made happens right there in the CRM. And it's all contextualized. All the activity history is saved. So I do love that. I mean, that's an advertisement for just tracking any business process. It's not Salesforce. It's just, can we have informed contextual discussions and decisions about how we're going to move this ball from A to B? And do we have clarity about what, like the, we have a micro step here from A to B, but do we have clarity about the bigger, longer term goal that we're trying to achieve, which is ultimately growing a really happy, really large, multi-million dollar customer?
That's right. Yep. Yeah. Well, we're going to take that clip and send it off to Mark.
Yep. I should be able to charge a decent penny for that.
Yeah,
I would think. Yeah, I would absolutely think. It's kind of funny. I'm just reflecting, and yes, this is the old fart reflecting at this point. So I'm just going to get that on the table really early. There has been this perpetual feet dragging exercise that's gone on when migrating to something electronic. You know, and no matter what industry it is, I mean, I remember the idea of electronic medical records in healthcare, thinking that for God's sakes, you know, that was something that would, the value of that was astronomical and it should happen inside of 10 years. It's taken 30 or 40, you know, to really manifest itself in a meaningful way. The Honeywell deal was, the Honeywell conversion to Salesforce was 12 years ago, 13, 14, 15 years ago. When that started?
That is when I was.
Okay. So there was still a whole crop of bodies then that was pushing back hard on, we don't want to be tracked. Don't these people know that we're going to strip clubs? at lunch. And we're not, and of course we say wink, wink that we're taking customers there to try and close these big opportunities. But
there was
a hypothetical
inefficiency.
Purely a hypothetical.
I would say, hypothetically speaking, yes, I did observe inefficiency in the business.
Hypothetically speaking. There was the occasional moment when somebody wasn't as diligent as they should have been.
Yeah.
Rare, mind you, but yes, it did happen.
I mean, that's an interesting segue. You know, what pops into my mind instantly on the point of efficiency. I love our transition to a virtual workforce. I was somebody, Brent, I was in the office every single day for 10 to 12 hours a day. Yep. I had to do the commute. I had to wear the uncomfortable clothes, the uncomfortable shoes. I lived it for years. And I actually thought that I was somebody that would never really work in a remote environment. I didn't think I'd be productive. I thought I'd get distracted. Right. I thought it was good that I was in the office. And then all of a sudden, thanks to COVID, I'm at home every day, all day. And here we are. I haven't worn those uncomfortable shoes in 3 years. And, I couldn't be more productive. It is unbelievable. So you talk about a tech enabled business efficiency. I absolutely have a higher standard quality of work. I deliver more. I'm happier. Yep. I'm happier as a human. My family sees more of me. And we mitigate the downside by occasionally seeing each other. Now it's a whole separate conversation. I would also say my observation though.
You do mean the workforce. You do mean your employee group. You don't mean your family.
Oh yeah, no, I see
just,
the family.
Just to clarify that really quick.
Yeah. We mitigate the. Yeah, yes. Yeah. I see the coworkers on a semi-regular cadence.
I just wanted to be sure that we were clear.
Yeah, and when we do, it's really special, really valuable time. But we don't need it every single day. Yeah. And I was just going to parlay that to the way that customers buy. There's a lot of conversation about this is or isn't going to last in the way that large customers buy. They're always going to need the in-person piece. I'm not a believer of that. I have been hitting targets very, very successfully in a COVID world. I do not think that I could be selling more if I was in person. In fact, I believe I'd be selling less because of the transaction cost, the travel time. Mm-hmm. You can see fewer people. You can engage with fewer people. I love the digital world.
Yeah. I mean, look, I would say in a nutshell, I think many companies benefit from it. So you're able to create higher margin. You don't have a footprint. Right. Like you don't have an office building that you have to burn your lease dollars on. You don't have the travel. You're able to hit more customers in a day than you would if you had to go travel. I mean, there's a lot of efficiencies associated with it. I think it'll get easier as the years go by because the generation that's locked in the expectation of being in an office or having the face-to-face meeting in order to actually close the deal will start rolling off, over the years. But some organizations I would argue do have, they're more optimized when they are together. I think that some technology companies can amazingly perform and execute without having to be in the same place. Mm-hmm. I think an organization such as ours, a private equity organization, where we're talking about, let's talk about 6 to 7 deals at any given moment and having phone calls happening with customers or management teams or experts around the particular things that are going on within those organizations. And then, yes, you can drop it into the CRM, but actually dialoguing about how that impacts our investment thesis in real time is quite powerful, right? So this is the water cooler argument. I get it. I mean, I'm not trying to be that old guy because I actually was incredibly efficient when COVID was around and I was working from my office and we did incredible deals. We found ways to do it.
Yeah.
There's numerous schools of thought. I do think it's dependent on the organization though.
Totally true.
Yeah. I think it's also dependent upon the technology. I mean, now the three of us are looking at each other in HD. There's absolutely, I mean, you guys might as well be across the desk from me.
Absolutely.
You are across the desk from me.
Yeah.
Right.
No doubt.
And I think that's been a huge change. You didn't used to have that. You didn't used to have anything close to that. And I think the better our videos get, the faster, the more real time with high speed bandwidth and HD cameras and sound and all the rest of the stuff, you're living the real experience. And I think when, the virtual reality starts coming or augmented reality starts coming in, it's going to get even more significant.
Yeah.
Right.
I agree.
All right, everybody. That does it for part one of our second conversation with Brent Granato. We will be coming back soon, next couple of weeks, with the conclusion of the conversation. Talk to you soon. 70% of enterprise IT projects and 95% of the big ones, those over $1 million, fail. A third are complete write-offs. A third deliver half of what was promised, but cost twice as much. The rest are just bitter disappointments. 75% of all those failures are caused by one critical oversight that everybody makes, but nobody knows they're doing it. This podcast is about explaining and correcting that mistake. But if you need help faster, you can always reach us at bridgingbusinessit.com. In 2 weeks, we'll show you how to spot and fix that oversight so it never happens again.